This is disc number 3.
Using a shiny 8-foot brass pole with a hooked end, he reached up and unlatched the lock and pushed open the hatch. Then he stood the ladder up, bracing it against the opening, snow already falling into the library. He climbed 15 steps before emerging onto a small open veranda, the highest point of Emerald House. The panoramic eyeful of the four wings and chimneys and the surrounding basin distracted Ezekiel for a split second before he saw them. 5 figures near the wrought iron railing on the east side of the platform. Bart Packer and his servants. 3 had slumped over, face first and half buried in the newly fallen snow. 2 still sat upright, Bart one of them, his face black, purple, and distended beyond recognition from what looked to have been a merciless beating. Their throats had been opened, the snow in the vicinity stained with great quantities of blood.
"Son of a bitch," he whispered. "Son of a bitch."
It snowed again, but the wind whipping across the roof kept the platform mostly bare. He heard approaching footfalls, spun around. Stephen climbed through the trapdoor onto the roof.
"God damn, son," Ezekiel said, shouting to be heard over the wind. "Lucky I didn't have my gun. You'd have been belly up, coming up on me like that. What'd you leave my wife?"
He saw Gloria coming up the steps behind the preacher. Ezekiel rushed past Stephen, stood blocking her view of Bart and the servants.
"You seen it?" he asked her.
"Seen what?"
"Oh, sweet Jesus," Stephen said.
"Glory, Glory, look at me. My eyes, they're up here."
"Dead?"
"Had their lamps blown out, I'm afraid, and trust me, less you alkalied to it, sight like this, you'll spend the rest of your life trying to forget."
"But you seen it."
"Awful to say, but I seen worse. I done worse," he thought. "Now I'm madder in hell you came up here when I said stay put, but I can probably let that slide if you listen to me."
He held her face in his hands.
"Look here, Glory, go on back down now. Go on."
He watched her descend back through the trap door, then walked up to Stephen, said,
"Man, where the fuck is your head? My wife almost saw this. Got half a mind to throw your ass off this roof."
But the preacher stood stone-faced and glaze-eyed, staring at the stiffs and all of that red snow surrounding them.
"Who do you reckon would do a thing like this?"
"Bad men," Ezekiel said. "Looks to have been done with a couple of Arkansas toothpicks. Nasty work. They were probably worried about gunshots setting off a slide, blocking their way out of the basin."
Stephen started toward the dead. Ezekiel grabbed him by the shoulders, drew him back.
"Best to let him lie for now, Preach. What can you do?"
Stephen nodded. His hands shook. He tried to steady them.
"Is it any wonder, Zeke, that he hates us?"
"Who?"
"God."
"Wait. You saying God hates his own creations?"
The preacher gestured at the carnage.
"Wouldn't you?"
20. When she opened her only Christmas present of 1893, Harriet McCabe ran shrieking in circles around the 10x10 cabin where she lived with her parents. It was by leaps and bounds the most extravagant gift she'd ever received. Her mother having skimped on their family's last 3 food orders so she could purchase the doll from the general store's window. Samantha was 16 inches tall, came with 2 dresses and a little comb to brush her luxurious red hair.
"Now I understand why we've been eating pooch and splatter dabs for supper instead of meat," Billy grumbled,
still stretched out and hung over on the lumpy straw-filled mattress. Bessie said,
"It's fine to make the sacrifice. Look at your daughter, Billy. You ever seen her so happy? Don't it warm your heart even a little?"
Harriet sat on the dirt floor by the sink, just a wash basin on an upended packing crate, whispering secrets to Samantha.
"Fire's getting low," Billy said. "Go on, bring in some wood from the porch. This shithole's drafty as hell."
"Billy, that mouth. It's Christmas morning and your daughter..."
"Get going, I said."
So Bessie wrapped every available blanket around her underpinnings and stepped into Billy's arctics. When she'd gone outside, Billy sat up in bed and raised his arms over his head. At 20 years, he was small and looked young for his age, with jittery eyes that caused most men to treat him like a boy. He was handsome until he opened his mouth. His front teeth had resembled jagged canines ever since his father had broken them when Billy was 9. He got up, the dirt floor freezing, his head pounding. He could feel the morning cold slipping through his stained and threadbare long drawers. He staggered to the table, covered in oilcloth and a few air tights of rarities they'd saved for Christmas. Billy pried open a tin of mustard sardines, crammed a handful into his mouth. He went over to the cabin's only window and swept back the curtains Bessie had sewn out of an old lace-edged petticoat. Nothing to see of the outside world, condensation having frosted the inside of the glass. A whiskey bottle filled with tiny seashells sat in the windowsill. He ran a finger across the glass and thought of his big brother Arnold. Missed him so much in that moment, he felt his throat close up, went short of breath, like someone had punched him in the gut. Billy turned around, looked at his daughter. "Merry Christmas, girl," he said. The 6-year-old glanced up at her father, and he saw the wariness in her eyes, and it shot him full of sadness and vexation.
"Got a present for your mama," he said.
And he reached under the bed and lifted something the size of a small loaf of bread packaged in newspaper. He walked over to the spruce sapling they'd uprooted from the hillside above their cabin. Bessie had potted it in a lard bucket, kept it watered, but the needles had begun to brown at the tips. Billy placed the package on the flour sack wrapped around the base of the Christmas tree.
You like that doll? Billy asked, blushing as he always did when he stuttered, no matter that he was conversing with his 6-year-old.
He'd never had a speech problem before coming to Abandon.
Yes, sir.
That's good. Cost a damn sight more than we can afford.
He lifted the lid and peered into the graniteware pot on top of the stove. The snow had finally melted, tiny bubbles rushing up from the bottom. He took his tin cup down from one of the newspaper-lined shelves above the wash basin and poured the hot water over the old Arbuckle's grounds.
Christmas morning ain't even got a decent cup of coffee to sip. This is belly wash.
The front door swung open and Bessie stumbled in with 2 armloads of firewood and a draft of bitter cold. She dropped them on the floor, opened the iron stove, shoved in 3 logs.
Guess it's still snowing, Billy said,
noticing the streaks of white in Bessie's yellow hair.
Coming down like it got no mind to stop. Dust me off, will you?
Billy walked over, brushed the snow off her blankets.
Well, looky what's under the tree, he said.
Bessie saw the small package on the flour sack and smiled.
I didn't think you got me nothing.
Bessie draped the blankets over the rocking chair beside the stove and approached the dying spruce. She lifted the present.
Heavy.
Come over to the bed.
Bessie sat down on the mattress. Harriet crawled over, crouched at her parents' feet. Bessie ripped off the old newspaper.
Holy God, Billy!
What lay in Bessie's lap amid the torn newspaper was inconceivable. A dream.
I weighed it, Billy said. 22 pounds.
Mama, let me see.
Bessie hoisted the bar of solid gold, the metal freezing cold to the touch, marred with scrapes and tiny chinks, a dully gleaming bronze.
How much?
She asked.
Gold's at $20.67 an ounce, so you're holding more than $7,000 right there.
It was more money than Bessie had ever heard of. She began to cry. Billy put his arm around her.
Where'd you get this?
Bessie asked. Billy sipped his coffee. The grounds had been used and reused so many times they barely even colored the water.
Look at this place.
He waved a hand at their shanty.
We live in squalor, he said. Ain't you tired of it yet? This floor turning to mud every time it rains. Chinks falling out. These goddamn drifts in the kitchen from snow blowing through the walls.
Where'd you get it?
Bessie asked again.
I don't think you need to know. We're rich, Bessie. Concern yourself with that. Oh, and this ain't the only one.
What do you mean?
He grinned.
That bar's got a whole mess of brothers and sisters.
Bessie dropped the bar on the bed and stood up. With her hand, she framed Billy's acne-speckled face. He'd been trying for a mustache the last 6 months, but it looked patchy and ridiculous.
I need to know right now what you done, she said.
He swatted her hands away.
What you mean, what I done?
I'm providing for my fucking family.
Billy, when you brought the high grade home from the mine, I didn't like it, but I let it go. Next thing I know, we got a half ton of ore in the root cellar. I said nothing. But that,
she pointed at the bar of gold.
You take it from the godsend?
What if I told you I found it and...
I'd call you a black liar.
He jumped to his feet and grabbed Bessie's arms and shoved her toward the kitchen. She crashed into the wash basin and the shelves. A can of condensed milk fell on her head. Jars of sugar, long sweetening, flour, and salt shattering on the dirt floor. When Bessie looked up, Billy stood over her, eyes twitching, face blood red. Harriet had disappeared under the table, but her crying filled the cabin. Billy ripped the oilcloth off the table, glared at his daughter.
Now you shut that fucking yap, Harriet. I'm speaking to your mother, and I don't want to hear peep one out of you.
The little girl buried her face in her dress to muffle her sobs.
Your daughter, Billy, Bessie screamed. That's your...
Billy grabbed his wife by the ankles and dragged her toward the bed. He picked her up and slammed her onto the mattress, climbed on top of her, pinning her underneath his weight.
Listen, you ungrateful cunt, he whispered, straining to hold her down. By God, I'll make you be still.
He slapped her twice. Bessie quit struggling. They lay pressed together, panting. Bessie trying not to gag at the fishy reek of Billy's breath.
It's Otha, ain't it? Bessie said. He got you into something. You changed since you taken up his company.
Billy pressed his forearm into his wife's neck and leaned into her windpipe.
Make no mistake, he whispered. One word, I'll fucking kill you, simple as that.
And your daughter, Billy, she wheezed, gonna kill Harriet too?
Bessie saw it happen. The madness spilled over in Billy's eyes, and she knew he would suffocate her.
All right, baby. All right.
She'd been digging her fingers into his biceps, but now she let go and ran her fingers through his greasy, sandy blonde hair.
Billy!
She couldn't produce anything louder than a whisper.
Billy! I can't breathe!
It passed. He let up on his wife's neck, but he still lay sprawled on top of her as she coughed and gasped for air.
You're gonna make me kill you one of these days, Billy said.
All Bessie could do was stare into his twitching eyes. It wasn't anger she felt toward him, not anymore, only fear and profound sadness, because so little about him resembled the person she'd married in West Tennessee at 14. That sweet and tender boy felt as distant as her father, long dead from stone on the chest. Her eyes caught on the bottle of seashells in the window. She thought of that happy summer in 89 when they'd taken a steamboat down the Mississippi to visit Billy's brother on the Gulf Coast. It was the first and last time she'd seen the ocean, but she'd never lost the smell of it or forgotten the cool shock of salt water running under her feet that morning she and Billy had walked the beach together collecting those shells. Billy rolled off of her and sat up. Bessie touched the swelling knot on top of her head.
You never beat me in Tennessee.
When'd you give me cause? Now, this gold. We got a problem?
No, Billy.
Well, all right then.
He sighed and got up from the bed, walked back over to the table, knelt down. Harriet still had her head buried in her gingham dress, so all he could see of her was a battery of black curls.
Come on out of there now, girl. Me and your mama's all right. Sometimes adults have to talk things out, find a remedy for a situation.
The little girl lifted her head, eyes still brimming with tears.
Come on now, honey. Your doll's over there on the floor all alone. She's upset, too. What's her name?
Samantha.
Are you just gonna leave Samantha over there to cry by herself? Ain't you her mama now?
As Harriet crawled out from underneath the table, Billy said,
Well, how's about we crack open a can of oysters? It's Christmas after all, ain't it?
And Billy flashed Bessie his broken-tooth smile. Bessie thinking,
I don't know if it's this town or Otha that done it, but you ain't the same. This thin air's poisoned you. Ain't my Billy no more. I've lost you.
21. Christmas morning, Otha Wallace slung his oilskin slicker over the coat rack and breathed in the smell of Joss Maddox's cigarette.
Coming down, huh?
She called out from behind the bar.
Otha removed his slouch hat, beat the felt brim against his leg to dislodge the snow, and replaced it on the tangle of wavy black hair that fell to his shoulders. He strode to the pine bar where Joss had already poured 2 tumblers of whiskey and uncapped a bottle of Pabst Blue Ribbon.
"So," she said, "how merry of a Christmas is it?"
He opened his coat, reached into the inner pocket.
"We got there with both feet."
When Joss saw the bar of gold, she went moist between her legs, reached out and touched Otha's hand. He drank both tumblers and took a long pull of beer.
"Tell me, Jossie."
"Joss."
"Damn, you're snorty. Who's the woman across the street sitting up in that bay window? She watches me every time I pass by."
"Molly Madsen, and you ain't special. She watches everyone."
"What is she? A lunger? Up here for the rarefied air?"
"No. 10 years ago, her husband sent her out here to set up a home. He knew Bart somehow, was going to assay for the mine. Well, he never came, never wrote, just up and quit her."
Otha smiled.
"Bart felt awful about it, put Molly up in the hotel when she finally ran out of money. Been supporting her ever since. What I've heard, Molly went crazy as a sheep herder over it. Hasn't left that room in 5 years. Still thinks her husband's coming for her."
"I had a feeling she was sent for supplies."
He pointed at the tumblers. She filled them. He drank again, then stepped quietly over to the pot-bellied stove, so as not to rouse Al, the deputy, who'd once again drunk himself into an unconscious stupor. Otha warmed his hands, which were heavily calloused and perennially black with mine dust and grime. He wore 30-year-old garments from his stint fighting for the Confederacy, gray trousers and a matching double-breasted frock coat with pewter buttons. There was a single row of braids on the left sleeve, denoting his rank as junior officer in the infantry. He'd long since ripped off all other insignia. Old wax drippings marred the shoulders of his frock coat, a telltale sign of his employment with the mine. Lana sat at the piano, having come to the saloon at first light. Otha walked over, stood watching her play. When she'd finished the song, he clapped, put his hands on her shoulders, said,
"Merry Christmas, Miss Hartman. You sure do a beautiful job filling out that corset and camisole, if you don't mind me saying. I was wondering if you'd take a walk across the street to the hotel. Thought you and me could exchange presents. I'd sure fancy a trim..."
"Oath?" Joss said his name softly, but her voice cracked with rage, her black eyes smoldering.
"Come here. Quit pie rooting.
I'm talking with Miss Hartman at the moment. I'd extend you the same opportunity, but seeing as how you're presently chained..."
"Son of a bitch. Put this plain, I'll cut off your grapefruits."
Lana fixed her gaze on the yellowed ivory keys, paling, trembling. Otha sidled back up to the bar.
"Why you so knotted up? You her fucking madam?"
Joss smiled and made a move so deft and graceful the next thing Otha knew the right side of his face had slammed against the bar, Joss cradling his head, a cold knife point digging into his left ear.
"Swear to God,"
Joss whispered, wisps of her black hair tickling his mustache.
"I'll jam it straight through whatever brains you got left in there."
"Go on playing now, Lana. It's all right. You won't be bothered no more."
Otha chuckled, though he didn't dare move. From his tilted vantage point, he could see Al, a half-grin on the lawman's face as he shaded in oblivious repose beside the stove.
"Joss, would you accuse me of exaggeration if I said that is the most useless cocksucker I ever laid eyes on?"
"Al?"
"Yeah."
"No, I wouldn't contradict that statement. Now I'm gonna let you up, and you and me is gonna come off the rim rock. Behave yourself."
Joss released him, shoved the bowie back into its leather sheath under the bar. She set up 2 tumblers while Otha retrieved his hat. They raised their glasses.
"To your impending release,"
Otha whispered. They clinked and drank. Joss glanced at the sleeping deputy, then whispered,
"How'd it go last night with old Bartholomew?"
"It went."
"Smoothly? Without incident?"
"Well, by the end of the proceedings, Bart sure as shootin' wished he'd never yapped to you about them bars.
What I mean is, you did it quick, right? There weren't no need to drag it out, make things any harder on the man than necessary.
Billy fucked it up.
How?
Particulars ain't important. It got done what needed to get done.
You saying the boy was rough on him?
Well, Billy hadn't never done nothing like it before. He got carried away, but...
That little shit.
Otha withdrew a scrap of paper from his flap pocket, slid it across the bar. Joss unfolded it, saw where Otha had scribbled something on a torn-out Montgomery Ward page advertising hobnailed miner's boots.
Fuck is this?
Wrote it last night. Notes for what you need to do tomorrow when I come back for you.
She lifted her suspenders and slipped the paper into the patch pocket of her plaid dress shirt.
What of the boy? You trust him?
Shit, no. What other choice I got? Can't play a lone hand, haul it all up there myself, can I?
Oath?
It'll get taken care of. You just worry about them notes I made for you. We do this right, everything'll work out. Now this child's gotta haul out. This ain't gonna be easy in a blizzard.
Know this, when the time comes, I'll be the one to take care of that hobble-tongued chore boy.
Joss,
ain't arguing with you about it. He gave Bart a rough shake. Boy, gonna by God learn something about pain on his way to hell.
Otha headed for the coat rack. He'd just done the last button on his slicker and reached for the door when Joss called his name. He turned back. She held up the piece of paper he'd given her.
Before I say this, she said, let me warn you. If I see a grin, a smirk, an eye roll, one fucking hint of condescension...
Jesus Christ, chew it finer. I gotta go get Billy.
She shook the paper.
Can't use this.
What does that mean?
It means I can't use it, Otha.
Oh.
He started back toward the bar.
I said not a fucking word.
I just said, oh. It ain't a judgment. Why didn't you tell me this when I give it to you in the first place? Think I give two shits whether you can read or not?
2009. 22. Abigail returned to consciousness, aware of only two things. The staggering pain in her head, and the echo of voices, one of them her father's.
Don't say that to me again, Lawrence. You know exactly why we're here. And now that your partner's out of commission? I swear to you, I ain't believing this. Motherfucker wants me to take him apart.
Put away the knife, Isaiah. He's gonna talk, I can feel it.
That true, Larry? My man Stu knows some shit I don't. This is just a huge misunderstanding?
Yeah, a huge...
Oh, no, no, no. All right, Lair. After I slice off your thumbs, we'll continue this.
Okay,
No, I think I better go ahead.
We have to go to Emerald House.
Big mansion up the trail?
Yeah.
Abigail opened her right eye. It took 5 seconds for the darkness to sharpen into focus. She sat with Lawrence, Emmett, and June inside one of the ghost town structures, her hands bound behind her back. It all looked familiar. The archways, the collapsed staircase, the climbing rope still dangling from the second floor. Three men, she assumed they were men, dressed in night camouflage and face masks, busied themselves packing an assortment of equipment into black backpacks. Under the archway leading into the lounge, Scott lay holding his abdomen, moaning softly. She wondered if Jared's body had just been left in the street.
Didn't I shoot someone in that old house?
She leaned into Lawrence, whispered,
"What's happening?"
As he turned, she saw that his right eye had been closed from a vicious blow.
"I don't know yet, but..."
One of the men finished zipping his backpack and walked over, crouched down in front of Abigail.
"Dirty Harriet,"
he said, grinning a big mouthful of straight white teeth through a slit in the face mask. She recognized his voice. It belonged to the man who'd threatened Lawrence, Isaiah.
"Bad with that little Ruger, ain't you? You'd have killed my man Stu if he hadn't been sporting Kevlar. Nasty cut over your eye. Need stitches."
He pulled out a roll of medical tape from his pocket, tore off a strip.
"But this'll have to do."
She groaned when he pinched the gash above her left eyebrow, closed and slapped on the tape. Then Isaiah and his partners donned black parkas and trousers over their coveralls, each man also wearing black neoprene gloves and Gore-Tex-lined leather combat boots. One of them pulled a fifth of Kettle One out of his pack, unscrewed the cap, took a long drink.
"Stew! What the fuck?
You want my hands to shake? Besides, my ribs are killing me. Might be cracked.
So take a fucking aspirin."
Isaiah came and squatted down facing June, Emmett, Abigail, and Lawrence. He looked them over, said,
"In a minute, we're going to cut your nylon restraints. You'll be free to move, but I would advise you to follow my orders to the letter."
He held up a machine pistol.
"Let me tell you about this work of art. Custom Glock 18, automatic suppressor, aim point, 33 cart mag. We each have one, and we won't hesitate to aerate your ass if you deviate 1 millimeter from our directives. Ain't gonna be no love tap from a taser you fuck up again. You feel me?"
Nods.
"Can I get a yes, sir?"
He pointed the machine pistol at June.
"Yes, sir."
Then he aimed it at Emmett.
"Yes, sir."
"What about Scott?"
Abigail said, nodding toward the archway.
"Motherfucker look like he can walk to you? He had a seizure before you woke up."
Isaiah leaned in toward Abigail. Their faces barely an inch apart, his breath smelled of cinnamon chewing gum. 2 years ago, while waiting to catch a cab after a Christmas party in the East Village, she'd felt something push into her back, followed by low, menacing words in her ear.
"Wanna die tonight, bitch?"
She'd never seen his face, just listened to his footsteps running up the sidewalk 30 seconds later. He'd taken her purse, earrings, necklace, and left her with something that ruled her even to this moment. The ever-present knowledge of how fast a normal day, a normal evening, could turn into her being raped and bleeding out on the sidewalk. No such thing as safety or control. The worst moments of your life you never see coming, although she had to admit something had seemed wrong about this trip since the previous morning at the trailhead, when she'd caught that look between Scott and Lawrence. Had they known this was coming? The man called Isaiah still spoke to her.
"That your boyfriend? Y'all fucking? What?"
She shook her head.
"I poked him in the gut. Be dead in an hour, maybe less. Painful way to go. But if you'd rather stay with him..."
He slid a Fairburn Sykes from an ankle sheath and pressed the knife point under her right eye.
"I'll be happy to leave you here. 'Cause the truth, bitch, is that I don't need you."
Abigail stared into his large white eyes through the holes in the mask. They reminded her of eggs. She felt his sweet breath on her mouth, the cold of the blade against her cheek. She shook her head again.
"That's what the fuck I thought. Now I didn't get my yes sir from you."
23. The orders were brutally simple. Walk. Keep quiet. Step out of line, you get shot. Lights on at all times. They'd even given Abigail fresh batteries for her headlamp. Isaiah led the way, the four captives following single file, his partners bringing up the rear. Abigail walked between Lawrence and June, snow already accumulating in the grass and on abandoned, splintered remnants. With her hands free, she managed to scrape the dried blood out of her left eye. She could see now, but her head still throbbed like hell and her bones felt weak and jittery. Her nervous system torqued from the taser. They passed their campsite on the outskirts, the llamas huddled between the tents. Abigail lusted after the cell phone in her pack. Soon they'd left abandon, gotten a half mile up canyon, the ruts of the old wagon trail filling with snow and nothing to be seen but the flakes passing horizontally through the headlamp's beams, tiny planets of light in that galaxy of darkness and wind. Abigail heard June struggling to stifle sobs. She reached back, felt June squeeze her hand, tears gliding down Abigail's face now as she tried to comprehend the murder of Jared, Scott tied up alone as he bled to death in that degenerated hotel, and how in God's name she was walking at gunpoint through a snowstorm in this secluded canyon, too horrified even to contemplate what their captors intended to do with them. Isaiah veered off the main trail. They climbed narrow switchbacks up the hillside. Soon the procession was 400 feet above the canyon floor, scrambling over scree. Through the gap between the mountains, Abigail walked so close to her father that the steel toes of her Oslo boots occasionally banged into his heels. She thought she heard the trickle of running water, a stream, a spring perhaps. Another half mile and they'd come to the edge of a lake. It stood mostly unfrozen, the wind pushing ripples that lapped at the fragile ice extending out a foot from the bank. Isaiah had started in the direction that would take them around the north side when Lawrence said, "That's not the best route." Isaiah stopped, looked back. "There's a rock glacier on that end, a quarter mile ahead. Drops right into the lake. It's steep. Very dangerous. Our party had a near miss yesterday with this type of situation."
"You know I trust you, Larry. But do you know why?"
"No. No, sir."
"Because I know that you know I will fuck your ass up if you give me bad information."
They followed the south shore around Emerald Lake. Deep in the basin, the wind had died. Snow fell vertically again, and aside from the whisper of its collection, there was no sound save for the labored breathing of the party and the squeak of boots in the inch of new snow. Across the lake lay the rock glacier, boulders shifting, smashing into one another. From several hundred yards away, their collisions sounded like small-caliber gunshots. Stu yelled suddenly from behind,
"Hey, what was that? You see that?"
Everyone stopped. "What you got?" Isaiah said, reaching for his machine pistol.
"I saw a light."
"Where? I don't see anything."
"Straight ahead."
As Abigail stared into the distance, she didn't see a light either, only the hulking shadow of Emerald House.
"I'm telling you, Isaiah, it didn't last long, but this light, a candle, whatever it was, just winked on and off."
"What floor was it on?"
"I don't know. It happened so fast."
"Anyone else see this light?" No one answered.
"Larry, you the expert."
"No one's lived there in 116 years.
"I'm just telling you what I saw," Stu said.
"Maybe I'm a little fucked up is what. You got every other day of your life to be a drunk motherfucker. I need you to hold your shit together tonight. You do that for me?"
"Yeah, Isaiah. Sorry."
Abigail filled with apprehension as she walked the last 100 yards to Emerald House. She'd never seen anything like it. This rambling edifice enveloped in darkness and silence and ruin. The corpse of what it had once been. Wet snow clung to the facade. Windows busted out. Shingles peeled off. 4-story chimneys toppled into piles of rock. The north wing was a shambles but intact, its southern counterpart long since collapsed on itself, the winter snows crushing it through the years, until all that remained was the foundation and a small mountain of demolished framework. Isaiah followed the stone pathway up to the portico, passing between the massive rotting Douglas fir trunks. Yellow notices had been stapled to the oak doors. Forest Service warnings regarding the instability of Emerald House, threatening all trespassers with aggressive prosecution. A feeble attempt had been made to chain the iron handles together. Isaiah called out, "Bolt cutter!" And Stu came forward with his pack, unzipped it, and produced the requested tool. One easy snip and the chain fell onto the sandstone. Isaiah grabbed the door handles, hesitated.
"Larry?" he called out. "It would be awfully tragic if some heavy shit was to fall on my head. Why don't you come do the honors?"
Abigail watched her father walk under the portico.
"Your show now,"
Isaiah said as Lawrence pushed open the doors and led the way inside. 24.
"Jesus, this place is huge."
Isaiah let the beam of his headlamp pass through the foyer.
"My light doesn't even reach the far end. We safe in here, Lair?"
"No, but this is the most stable part of Packer's mansion." The foyer smelled dank, redolent of mildew and wet wood. From her spot in line, Abigail shone her light on the cracked marble floor, saw piles of scat, puddles of ice. Through a hole in the roof, snowflakes drifted down. She removed one of her mittens, let her fingertips graze the stone wall. Cold and soft and wet, carpeted in dead lichen.
"There's a journal in my pack," Lawrence said. "I need to see it."
Isaiah unzipped it, pulled out a black spiral-bound notebook. As Lawrence took it and sat down on the cascading staircase, Abigail couldn't stop herself.
"What's going on here, Lawrence?"
Isaiah grinned.
"You don't know?"
He laughed, his southern-tinged voice reverberating through the foyer.
Nice, Larry. Very nice. More I get to know you, more I like you.
When Abigail aimed her light in her father's face, she recognized the guilt and the circuit closed, connecting on some primordial level to that girl who still inhabited her, and a subconscious memory, 26 years old, of that exact look of shame when her daddy had slipped into her bedroom one night to say that he had to go away.
What have you done?
I'm sorry, Abby. I'm so sorry.
For what? Tell me.
Isaiah's hand passed through the beam of light. She fell. The darkness tingled. Emmett started forward, but his nose ran into the barrel of Stu's machine pistol. He held up his hands, retreated. Isaiah knelt down, grabbed Abigail's ponytail, lifting her head so their eyes met.
My man's got some serious shit to attend to. Next time, the fist will be closed. You'll lose teeth. Now get the fuck up.
He jerked her by her hair, pulling her to her feet.
And shut the fuck up.
That isn't necessary, Lawrence said, his voice trembling.
Tend to your notebook, Stu warned.
Abigail touched her cheek. The bruise burned.
All right, Lair. Where are we going?
I'm not 100% sure, since I haven't actually seen it. This is all theoretical, based on my research. I was going to try and find it on this expedition.
You bullshitting me, Larry? Don't make me. Will you give me 2 damn minutes here? I'm not saying I can't take you to it. I just need more time.
Lawrence studied his notebook, flipping through several pages. Somewhere nearby, water dripped, followed by a faint and distant scratching. From high above came the chirp of a pika. Lawrence finally closed his notebook, stood up.
Bart's wing.
Lead the way.
Lawrence guided them out of the foyer, toward the staircase that rose up the center of Emerald House.
Last one of these we went up collapsed, he said to Isaiah.
You haven't been up here?
Not since last summer. I'm sure it's weakened.
Then you best tread lightly. I'll be behind you.
Abigail was third in line, and to her relief the staircase felt much sturdier than the flimsy death trap in the hotel. Part of the banister was missing, but none of the steps creaked. As they reached the next floor, Stu whispered,
Isaiah, hold up. I hear something.
Their beams of light swept through what remained of the second level. Tall door frames and window frames, 3 wings still intact. The south reduced to a hole so gaping you could drive a bus through it, snow blowing sideways into the mansion and slowly rotting everything it touched. Another winter or two, the water damage would reach the stairwell.
Stu, I don't know what I'm gonna do if this is another false.
Isaiah suddenly lifted his machine pistol, motioned for his partners to do the same. Abigail heard it too, the rapid patter of footsteps. Isaiah and Stu moved soundlessly side by side away from the stairs toward the west wing. 20 feet in, Isaiah stopped and held up his hand, pointing at a closed door a little ways into the passage. Isaiah looked at Stu, counting down from 3 with the fingers of his right hand. He kicked the door, which exploded back off its rusted hinges. The mansion filled with ear-splitting shrieks, like those of women being murdered. A host of shadows flew out of the room toward the stairs. June screamed, and amid blinding muzzle flares, Abigail heard panting and the muffled clatter of machine pistols. A half dozen coyotes blitzed past Abigail, heading down the stairs and into the foyer, their yaps at once jovial and demonic as they escaped through the oak doors into the night. 25. Lawrence led them to the east wing of the second floor. Abigail's head was killing her, and the left side of her face was hot, swollen. Her headlamp revealed a place of absolute decay, the wood-paneled walls warped and blackened with mold. They passed through a small sitting area and arrived at a pair of French doors. Lawrence pushed them open, the hinges grinding rust into rust. As they entered a short hallway, Lawrence pointed out the first door on the right.
That was Bart's office, he said. Door on the left opens into the guest room.
Abigail shone her light inside, sparsely furnished with 2 single beds, their posts and headboards smashed, mattresses disintegrated into mounds of rotted down, a capsized chest of drawers, fireplace, wardrobe. They went on, passing large picture frames that had fallen from the walls and lay in pieces on the floor.
"So what you got in that notebook that brought you to this wing?"
Isaiah asked. In 1889, Packer hired an architect named Bruce Price to design this mansion. I had a breakthrough last winter at the New York Public Library when I found Price's notes on the final floor plan. The original blueprints don't show this wing's true layout. Lawrence opened the door at the end of the hall and entered, followed by Isaiah and the rest of the party. Packer's bedroom formed the eastern extremity of Emerald House. 12-foot ceilings and large windows still holding glass that in decent weather would have offered a jaw-dropping view of the basin and lake. The walls tapered to a fireplace at the narrow end of the room, spacious enough to roast 6-foot logs. Isaiah motioned to Abigail and the Tozers.
"Y'all sit by the bed and stay quiet."
As Abigail sat down beside June, her headlamp brightened the headboard of Packard's bed. She noticed that a word had been carved into the wood, probably by some asshole with no respect for the past, just hoping to memorialize his girlfriend's name. Lana. It felt good to get off her feet, but her thermal underwear had soaked through with freezing sweat. She unzipped her purple moonstone parka and her pink fleece jacket.
"I have water in my pack," she said. "May I take it out?"
"Stu, y'all search their packs back in abandon?"
Stu and the other masked man had sat down near the hearth, their machine pistols trained on the captives.
"Yeah, their packs are fine."
Lawrence stepped through an open doorway beside the entrance to Packer's room.
"What's in there?" Isaiah asked.
And this was Bart's closet. Motherfucker was living the good life.
They disappeared into the walk-in closet. Abigail couldn't see her father, but she could hear him knocking on the walls. Lawrence spoke.
"If we were to break through this one, we'd be in Bart's office."
"Well, hell, let's be sure."
"I've measured. There's nothing strange about the rooms on this side of the hallway. They match up perfectly with the original architectural plans. Now follow me."
Lawrence and Isaiah emerged from the closet and walked back into the hallway. After a moment, Abigail heard Lawrence's voice again, indistinct and followed by more wall knocking. She worked her arms out of the day pack straps, reached in, and pulled out a Nalgene bottle. The water pumped and purified from the safe part of the stream that Scott had fly-fished the previous evening. The image of him dying in that hotel lobby felt like a stray ember behind her eyes. The water tasted cold and faintly sweet, so unlike the lead-tainted piss that ran out of her tap in New York. As she drank, she tried to ignore the red dots that traipsed across her chest. Lawrence and Isaiah returned to Packer's bedroom.
"This past summer, I made a thorough search of that guest room and found nothing," Lawrence said. "But I knew there was space between that room and Packer's room that was unaccounted for. I was getting ready to investigate Packer's room when the Forest Service showed up. I didn't have a permit to be here, and the fine would have been huge. I had to sneak out of the lodge."
He approached the enormous wardrobe to the right of the doorway, grabbed the side of it, tried to slide it out from the wall.
"It's bolted down or something."
"We've got grenades.
Want to bring the whole wing down?"
He pulled open the doors, climbed inside, Abigail listening as he banged around. After a moment, she heard,
"Aha."
Isaiah smiled.
"What I like to hear. What you got, baby?"
Lawrence's voice came back muffled.
"Entire back panel."
He struggled with something.
"Slides out."
A panel of wood flew out of the wardrobe and crashed onto the floor. Isaiah was peering in now.
"Would you look at that," he said. "You're a genius, Larry."
Isaiah pointed at Abigail.
"Come here. We may need you. It's a tight fit."
Abigail got up, crossed the floor. She stood beside Isaiah and looked into the wardrobe. With the panel removed, a black steel-hinged door was visible, 3 feet by 2 feet.
"Looks like some serious shit," Isaiah said.
"Hope for your sake you can open it." "Well, the bad news is this locking mechanism dates back to the 1860s. There are 4 locks requiring 3 different keys.
He touched the various keyholes.
"Here's the pin tumbler lock, here's the barrel lock, these 2 are bit styles."
"Aw, fuck. We are gonna have to toss a couple of grenades in here."
"Won't do anything. If this is the kind of door I suspect it is,"
He rapped his knuckles on it. It's made of 10 layered, 1/8-inch steel sheets. But there's some good news, too.
Pins and needles, Lair.
See here, 3 of the locks are already open. Only thing standing in our way is this bit lock, which has a turned bolt sealing the door.
So, what do we do?
Lawrence faced Isaiah. I'll be needing a guarantee.
A guarantee?
I spent the last 10 years trying to find what's in there. Now I'm willing to let it go.
Well, that's a relief.
If I have your assurance none of us will be harmed. Give me that. I'll get you inside.
Well, that'll put your little heart at ease.
It will.
Yeah. All right, Larry. You get me in there, you'll all walk out of these mountains.
That's the truth?
You questioning the word of a Marine?
Lawrence let his pack drop to the floor. He unzipped the outer pocket, scrounged inside. After a moment, he withdrew something, held it up in the light of his headlamp. Isaiah grinned through his mask at the long, toothed key.
Where'd you get that?
Found it in a safe in Bart's office last summer. I don't know for certain that this will open that bit lock, but it's the right type of key for it.
And what do we think is in there?
Abigail asked. Summer of 1871, Bart Packer was broke and prospecting alone in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. One afternoon, he got stuck above timberline in a thunderstorm, found an overhang high on the mountain, took shelter there. He was waiting for the storm to pass when he felt an icy draft coming from behind. He turned around, noticed an opening in the rock, and crawled through it. When he got his candle lit, he found himself in a large chamber, and not 10 feet away sat a headless skeleton clad in Spanish armor. Bart correctly deduced that he was looking at a conquistador, who'd most likely been in that cave since the 1500s. What lay beside the bones of this ancient conqueror was a pyramid of gold bars, 91 in all, 22 pounds apiece. That's about a ton of pure gold. When abandoned was in its heyday, it would have been worth $660,000. Today, with gold trading at $802 an ounce, Bart's 91 bars are worth over $25 million. Now, there may not be 91 bars in here, but even if he spent half of that, 12.5 mil's a good payday.
And you were just using this expedition as an excuse to find this gold?
Abigail said.
What were you planning to do? Sneak off with it without telling anyone?
No, of course not. Scott and I...
Scott knew?
Suddenly, that look between Scott and her father at the trailhead made perfect sense.
We couldn't haul it all out ourselves. That's 17 miles, and even if everyone carried as much weight as they possibly could, it'd take at least 2 or 3 trips. Besides, it's not just about the dollar value. Abigail, this was going to be a huge historical...
You son of a bitch. You selfish son. Time to open that motherfucker, Lair. Lawrence sighed, turned away from his daughter. He took his time, delicately working the key into the lock. The key turned, and the mechanism clicked.
It worked,
Lawrence whispered. He grabbed the handle, and when he'd heaved open the steel door, Isaiah shoved him aside and climbed into the wardrobe, his headlamp shining into a secret room the size of Packer's walk-in closet. Walls, floor, and ceiling made of stone.
You're fucking kidding me.
26.
Larry, where are my gold bars?
I don't understand. They should be in there. Isaiah shoved Lawrence out of the wardrobe.
Sit down, he yelled at Abigail. Not you, Larry.
Isaiah backed Lawrence up against one of the giant windows.
I'm telling you, they should be there. Maybe someone else.
You holding out on me? Isaiah unsnapped the ankle sheath under his trousers.
I swear,
Lawrence said.
They should have been in there. I don't know.
Maybe that's the case, Isaiah said. Then suddenly pressed the sharp, thin bone of his forearm into Lawrence's neck.
But how do I know? Really know you aren't lying.
I swear to you, I'm not. Please.
Words don't convince me, Larry. But you know what does? Pain, for instance.
Isaiah gently removed Lawrence's glasses, dropped them on the floor, crushed them under his boot heel.
I'm gonna cut out your right eye.
Abigail's stomach turned.
not happening. No, please.
Isaiah leaned harder into Lawrence's windpipe, briefly cutting off his air supply.
And give you 30 seconds to rethink your answer. If you're still maintaining you don't know where they are, I may be more inclined to believe you. Know why?
Lawrence shook his head, eyes bulging.
Because right now, you don't understand what real pain is. You think you do, but you don't. But when I'm holding your warm eyeball in the palm of my hand, you're gonna have a much better idea. You know that I'm willing and fully capable of taking you apart piece by piece. This is not about torture. It's about me knowing in my heart that you're telling the truth.
I say it, just listen, I need a minute to...
Sorry, Larry, this is the only way.
Stop it, please, Abigail begged. He's my father, he doesn't know.
Yeah, well, we're about to find that out for certain.
Isaiah set the point of the dagger under the lower lid of Lawrence's right eye. Lawrence struggled to cover his face.
Hold still, goddammit! Want me to accidentally push this into your brain?
Abigail jumped up and lunged for Isaiah, but someone tackled her from behind. She tried to fight him off, but he had her by the wrists in no time, his weight pinning her to the floor. She stared up into that masked face, inches from her own, didn't smell vodka, reasoned it couldn't be stew. What she could see of his eyes seemed strangely comforting, something familiar about them, so deep, burdened.
Because you recognize them,
Abigail whispered.
You weren't killed. That was an act for our benefit.
She jerked her wrist free and ripped off the man's mask, saw the scarred, bearded face of their guide, Jared Spicer.
The fuck, Jared? Isaiah said. You're with them?
Lawrence said, incredulous. She recognized my eyes. Jared got up, screamed.
Fuck! How do we walk away now?
You knew it might come to this, Isaiah said. That was always a possible...
It's already come to a whole hell of a lot more than you said it would. Why don't you take off your...
Isaiah stepped back from Lawrence, ripped off his mask.
Happy?
Abigail's headlamp illuminated the face of a 30-something black man she would have thought exceptionally handsome under different circumstances. His smooth-shaven features in perfect proportion, pronounced cheekbones, intense mud-colored eyes, dimples that caved when he let loose his broad and malignant smile. Jared lifted off Stu's face mask, and the first thing Abigail noticed were the ringlets of Stu's curly black hair, then the week's worth of stubble, thin lips, sunken red-rimmed eyes, saddest she'd ever seen. He'd been handsome once, but whatever monster was eating him inside had also sucked the life from his face, drawing it into an axe-thin blade of emaciation. Jared took Isaiah over to the window. Stu got up and joined them. They whispered. Abigail looked at her father. He still stood against the window, knees shaking, crying, the floor wet under his hiking boots and a dark stream sliding down his cheek and into his beard, as if he wept blood. It took him a moment to muster his voice.
There's one more place to look, Lawrence finally said.
They stopped talking. Isaiah walked over, crowded him up against the glass again.
Larry, I sincerely pray for your sake you aren't fucking with me.
27. They made their way back to the stairwell.
What's up here?
Isaiah asked as they ascended the second flight of steps.
Servants' quarters.
They reached the third floor, this level more devastated by the elements than the first or second. Up ahead in the west wing, the gabled roof had caved, their headlamps showing snow falling through the ceiling.
We need to go up one more, Lawrence said.
They climbed, wood creaking, bowing where they stepped. Abigail was the third to emerge into the cupola. She shone her light on walls lined with empty shelves, the books having long since disappeared, taken by vandals or reduced by time and moisture to wads of leather, paper, glue. Two chairs and a sofa had disintegrated on the floor. Half the stones had fallen out of the two hearths. Abigail edged toward an opening in the middle of the floor, peered down, her light beam shining to the ground level.
All right, Lair. Where is it?
Lawrence carefully moved over to one of the bookshelves and knelt down, the floor cracking. When he stood again, he held an 8-foot brass pole, severely tarnished with a hooked end. He looked up. They all looked up, lights converging on a square door in the ceiling. Lawrence reached up, unlatched the rusted lock, pushed open the hatch. Snow fell through the hole into the library.
You been up there before, Lair?
No, I always thought it was too dangerous. If the floor were to give way, it's a 50-foot fall. But, all things considered, I think it's worth the risk.
How the hell we gonna climb up through that hatch?
Lawrence pointed back to the bookshelf.
With that ladder?
Jared and Stu pulled the ladder out from under the long bookshelf, hoisted it up, and braced it against the opening.
Doesn't exactly look like a craftsman product,
Isaiah said, grazing his gloved hand across a cracked wooden rung.
I'll go up first, test it.
No, she will.
He waved Abigail over.
What's up there, Lair?
I don't know, maybe nothing.
That wouldn't bode well for you, for any of you.
He looked at Abigail.
Up you go.
She grasped the sides of the old ladder and began to climb, carefully easing her weight onto each rung. The fourth one snapped, but she caught herself. The tenth rung was missing. As she neared the top, snow collected in her hair. Then she scrambled out of the hatch, stepping onto the roof of Emerald House.
Stay in one spot, Lawrence shouted up at her. I have no idea how stable it is up there.
She backed away from the opening, leaned against the wrought iron railing that surrounded the small open veranda, snow blowing so hard into her face that she choked on it, had to cover her mouth with her hands. Lawrence came up, then Isaiah, Emmett, June, and finally Stu and Jared. Abigail rubbed her arms, and as she stood watching her father, it hit her. There was nothing on this veranda but an inch and a half of snow, and he looked nervous in the beam of her headlamp, like he was trying to pass off monopoly money for true currency.
Well, Lawrence said, kneeling down, inspecting a corner of the veranda, brushing the snow off the stone.
I'm just at a total loss, Isaiah.
Abigail gripped the iron railing. June and Emmett stood beside her, Isaiah with his back to her near a skylight that had long since been liberated of its glass.
You're at a loss, Isaiah said.
The hood of his parka had fallen back, snow collecting in his black hair.
What exactly does that mean, Larry?
It means I don't know where the gold is. I thought I did, but I don't. I'm horribly disappointed, believe me.
Sorry to hear that.
But it just isn't here. I don't know where else to look, and that's the truth. So here's what I'm thinking. We don't know a thing about you, so what if you three just leave us here? Disappear into the night. We never see you again. You never see us, and we never say a word. Not even about Scott. We'll pretend this never happened.
He's right, June said, staving off tears. Emmett and I would just be so grateful to be home again. To put all this behind us. I'm sorry you didn't find the gold you were looking for, but can't this be over now? You men came wearing masks, which tells me that you didn't come into these mountains intending violence.
We could just leave, Isaiah, Jared said. Scott and Lawrence know more about me than any of us, but I'd be willing to walk.
Lawrence said,
Look, we could spend tonight in Packer's mansion, give you guys a chance to head out. I'm telling you, it'd be like this never happened.
Isaiah stared at the snow-dusted stone beneath his feet.
Stu, he said, you got an opinion about this you'd care to toss into the hat?
I'm with you, man. Whatever you want to do, I'm with you.
Isaiah nodded. He turned around, looked at Abigail and the Tozers, who were standing together on the east side of the veranda. He approached them, faced Emmett.
I don't think I caught your name.
Emmett Tozer?
Cool if I call you Em?
Sure. June calls me that all the time.
Well, Em, he pointed at Lawrence. For this, you can thank that motherfucker.
He raised the machine pistol to Emmett's forehead, a red bead drawn between the man's widening eyes. June screamed,
No, it's not his fault!
The Glock coughed a burst of fire, and the back of Emmett's head blew out. He dropped to his knees, fell over sideways. In the low light, the blood looked like steaming oil as it blackened and spread through the snow. June threw herself over her husband's body, shrieking his name. Abigail tasted that salt and metal in the back of her throat again.
The worst moments of your life you never see coming.
She turned and spewed over the railing, knew, as the bile burned her throat, that she'd spend the rest of whatever life she had left trying to sever herself from this moment.
You happy, Lair? You greedy motherfucker!
Isaiah said, his voice rising. Abigail sank down into the snow. She could barely hear Isaiah speaking over the wind and June wailing.
Em, come back! Don't you do this!
Know what's gonna happen next?
Isaiah was in Lawrence's face now. Lawrence backed up into a corner of the veranda behind the hatch.
I'm gonna make that bitch get down on her knees, and you are gonna watch me put a bullet through her head. Then I'm gonna get...
Lawrence cried.
No, don't, I'll...
Isaiah grabbed his throat.
Don't ever fucking interrupt me. Then I'm gonna get this bitch,
he pointed at Abigail.
But I'm not shooting this one. I'm gonna take this knife and slowly cut her throat. Let you watch her drain.
Abigail looked at Jared, noticed his legs quaking. Stu had pulled the bottle of vodka out of his backpack and began to work off the cap.
And then, if you're still maintaining you don't know shit...
Abigail made herself stand. She wiped her mouth.
I'm gonna go to work on...
Isaiah! Jared yelled.
What?
Jared started toward him. They met at the skylight, both men covered in snow.
What the fuck?
He pointed at Emmett's body.
I did not sign up for this shit.
What are you saying?
You want out? That it?
I don't...
You know, you never had the stones to finish the hard shit, did you? I don't want out. I just... You didn't say it'd be like this.
Well, it is. So stop your fucking crybabying. Isaiah lifted his machine pistol, started toward June, who still lay sobbing on top of her husband.
You watching, Larry? I'll tell you whatever. You can tell me after. Just want to be sure you know I am not fucking around with you.
He stopped and put the gun to the back of June's head. Lawrence pushed off the railing, lunged toward Isaiah screaming. Jared and Stu running toward him. Isaiah swinging his machine pistol toward Lawrence. Abigail thinking,
I'm about to watch my father die.
Lawrence's fourth step brought him past the skylight, and all seven of them suddenly occupied the same 25 square feet of floor space. There was a deep crack, like a rafter fracturing, and the veranda of Emerald House caved in. 1893. 28. The preacher and the Curtises reached Abandon at noon, having descended from the massacre at Emerald House in half the time it had taken them to hike up into the basin. Ezekiel hurried them down the desolate middle of Maine and up a side street toward their cabin, his jaw set, eyes more intense than Gloria had seen them in a long while, enveloped in a slow burn. The preacher said,
Zeke, I think we should alert the town to...
Ain't arguing with you about it anymore, Stephen.
We've got vicious murderers roaming.
Ezekiel spun around.
Do I come into God's house of a Sunday morning, tell you how to preach a sermon?
Stephen shook his head.
Don't counsel me how to proceed in matters of the law.
Zeke,
Gloria grabbed his arm.
Look.
The hillside above town was dotted with smoking cabins, half buried in snow and tucked into groves of tree-lined spruce, web-trodden paths branching from each one to the side street. Bessie McCabe staggered toward them along the path from her cabin, Harriet in her arms, neither dressed for the weather, wrapped only in quilts, Bessie's flour sack underpinnings showing through, and no hat to be seen on mother or child as the snow gathered in their hair. Gloria could see that Bessie's face was flush with cold, the bruises on her left cheek turning purple and yellow around the edges.
Everything all right? Ezekiel asked.
Seen you coming up the street.
She whispered, trembling.
You're poorly,
Gloria said. Bessie looked downslope toward town, her eyes stormy with the weight of some damning choice.
I believe he's cut his wolf loose.
Who? The preacher asked. Tears were running over her lips now.
My Billy.
And Bessie's bare hand emerged from the blankets, grasping the bar of gold, snow falling on it, melting, making the yellow metal glisten.
He give me this morning, all wrapped up like some Christmas present. He wouldn't tell me nothing of how he come to have it.
Where's your husband right now? Ezekiel asked.
He left a few hours ago with Mr. Wallace.
Know where they went?
Rode off toward the mine.
You better come with us.
Why?
Ezekiel leaned in, whispered in her ear for the sake of the child. Packer and his lady's been murdered up at Emerald House. The bar of gold dropped from her hand and sank into the snow.
What you saying, Mr. Curtis?
In a town 123 souls, they ain't much breathing space for coincidence.
They killed him? Billy and Otha?
Nobody knows exactly who done what yet. Now, was it just Billy and Mr. Wallace, or was there more men?
I think it's just the two of them. You gonna hurt him?
I'm gonna bring him in. Whether or not he gets hurt or killed, that's his choice. He do that to you?
Bessie brought her hand to the bruises as if to hide them, eyes alight with shame.
Daddy done it,
Harriet said. Ezekiel brushed his gloved hand across the little girl's cheek.
I'm real sorry about that, sweetie. He ought not have.
Ezekiel squatted down, lifted the gold bar out of the snow, stood mesmerized by it, trying to disavow the shot of adrenaline it pushed through his veins, thinking if there was anything left in him of that man he used to be, he'd ride up to the mine with an entirely different purpose. Caught himself half wishing he'd stumbled onto an opportunity like this back in the old days. He handed the bar to the preacher.
You better keep this. Well, come on, ladies. No point in y'all standing out here freezing in them rags.
They walked up the street, then veered onto the path to the Curtis's little steeple-notched cabin. A barrel for a chimney pot, a root cellar on the south wall, and a sod roof that in the summertime sprouted sunflowers. At the front door, Ezekiel stopped, said,
Gloria, bring my rifle and the revolver for Stephen. We'll be needing a box of cartridges for each.
As the women went inside, Stephen said,
I'll not carry a gun, Zeke. You kidding me?
The preacher shook his head. But I will ride up with you.
The hell you gonna do if they start shooting?
I'm praying it won't come to that.
You see the same thing I saw up on the roof of Emerald House? That looked like the handiwork of men who talk things out? Hell, we'll have to get Doc now.
Glory returned with the old Schofield in one hand, Ezekiel's sawed-off Winchester in the other. Bessie was bawling inside, Harriet whispering,
It's all right, Mama. It's all right. Don't cry.
Ezekiel took the box of cartridges, his carbine by the barrel, said,
Man of God don't want the revolver, but you hang on to it. Better pull in the latch string and four it up. Don't go out. Don't open it for nobody. Billy or Otha or some rough-looking feller come by, you know what to do.
She nodded.
Better go on. Load up that Schofield now. Remember how I showed you?
Gloria threw her arms around his neck, felt the sandpaper of his face against hers, caught that smell of his that still melted her knees.
You come back to me,
she whispered. He lifted his hat and pulled off Gloria's sealskin cap so he could kiss her forehead and tug at those blonde curls.
Always have, Glory. Always will.
29. The cabin of Russell and Emma Ilg stood 100 yards north of the Curtis homestead and was unprotected by trees, so the snow had drifted to the roof on the windward side. Ezekiel followed the snow tunnel up to the front porch and pounded on the door. When it opened, a man with disheveled sandy blonde hair and thick spectacles grinned at them. He wore a brown sack coat and matching trousers, and his enormous mustache was freshly combed and waxed. The scent of soap emanated from him, the sour spice of whiskey on his breath. Over Russell's shoulder, Ezekiel saw Mrs. Ilg carrying a pot from her cook stove to a candlelit dinner table, already sagging under its load of steaming graniteware. A fire blazed in the hearth, and balled-up pages of newspaper lay around the base of the spruce tree. Their gifts, mostly homemade crafts, were lined up on the makeshift log mantel.
Merry Christmas, Zeke. Stephen. Tell me you ain't fixin' to eat, Doc.
Yeah, in about 5 minutes. Something wrong?
I really hate to do this to you.
What?
You ain't roostered, are you?
I had a nip of whiskey in my coffee a bit ago.
A nip?
I ain't drunk, Zeke. What's the problem?
Mrs. Ilg walked over, her silvering hair pinned up,
purple evening gown flowing across the dirt floor in her wake.
I'd rather say in private.
Merry Christmas, gentlemen, Mrs. Ilg said. Ezekiel and Stephen tipped their hats.
Ma'am?
Ma'am?
Well, do we have time to eat first?
Russell asked.
Afraid not.
What's going on here, Zeke?
We're having to borrow your husband. I apologize for the poor timing. It can't be.
I've been cooking all morning. Can't it wait, Justin?
Honey, if they need me now, they need me now.
Doc, we'll be waiting for you at the stables. Best bring your possibles and your rifle. Don't dawdle. We gotta light a shuck on this.
The livery had been erected a quarter mile north of town to save the residents from the persistent stench, but the wind, when it blew, tended to sweep in from the north, so it carried the odor of shit and trail-worn animals right up Main. In the boom years, the stink was eye-watering, even on the south end of town. But on Christmas Day in 1893, you couldn't smell the stables until you saw them. Ezekiel struck out with the preacher and the doctor, the sheriff astride a moon-eyed bay gelding he'd purchased in Silverton that fall. They rode through abandon and up canyon toward the godsend, the horses sinking to their knees, the riders' heads bowed, hat brims shielding them from the heavy slanting snow. At the turnoff to Emerald Lake, they picked up the only tracks they'd seen, a 10-burrow head and tail string led by two horses.
Can you think of a reason somebody'd be quick freightin' up to the godsend on Christmas when the mine shut down?
Russell asked.
Sure can't. And from the look of it, these poor animals are carrying some load, probably sinking past their stomachs.
They rode on, the sides of the canyon closing in, the blizzard diminishing their world until they could see only the tracks they followed. Another mile through deepening powder and Packer's 20-stamp operation appeared in the distance, a multi-level mill built into the back of the canyon, flanked by the mine office, lower boarding house, and a blacksmith shop.
Strange not to hear those stamps, Stephen said.
They stopped 20 yards from the mill. Ezekiel, already cold, beginning to shiver.
That's a concern, he said, pointing to where the tracks continued on,
not toward the mine as he'd anticipated, but up the south slope of the canyon.
You don't reckon Oath and Billy were foolish enough to drive that pack train up to the saw blade,
Russell said.
Well, unfortunately, it looks that way, don't it?
Well, that's desperate behavior. I don't like taking the dugway to the saw blade in July when the snow's gone.
The hell they got to lose. They murdered 5 people last night.
Well, I'm fair tired of this snow, and I don't relish the chore it'll be getting our horses up there.
Well, Doc, I don't either. I'd rather be back with Glory at the cabin, sitting by the fire, sipping whiskey, but that don't appear to be in my immediate future.
A great wedge of snow slid off the mill's sloped roof. The horses startled. The preacher said,
"Y'all think that slope could slide on us?"
"Yeah," Russell said. "I think it's entirely possible."
The three riders followed the tracks away from the mill. At the canyon's end, they paused, gazed up the smooth white slope. Ezekiel counting 5 switchbacks before the burrow trail vanished into the roiling, snow-swollen clouds.
2,000 feet up. Madness, Zeke. Pure madness.
I know it, Doc. And you're slick-heeled. Hope that Cremello of yours is clear-footed.
Don't worry. She may be light in the timber, but she's lady-broke, and she's got bottom.
Ezekiel spurred his horse on, and the riders began to climb.
This is the end of disc number 3. Please insert disc number 4.